Okay, well, good morning to everyone. Shavua Tov, Shushan Purim Sameach. I hope you've all had a wonderful Purim and that you've all dried out appropriately, and that we're now ready to start getting rid of the chametz and preparing for the new year of the Jewish people, the Aleph Nisan. What we're going to do today is take a look primarily at Sugya 16. If we have the time, I hope that we'll get to Sugya 17 as well. But the main thing is to analyze Sugya 16 for today. And if you'll recall, we learned Sugya 16 last week, at least the initial study of its structure. And I'd like to review that with you for a couple of minutes before we dive more deeply into analysis of the Sugya. The Sugya begins with the Mishnah, and we're primarily concerned with the second half of the Mishnah, which is that the Mikdash says to the woman, Omer Leisha, Harea Mikudeshetli, Leachar She'et Gayer, or Leachar She'tit Gayri. You're Mikudeshet to me after I convert, or after you convert. Leachar She'eshtachrer, or Leachar She'tishtachreri. After I am freed from my slavery, or after you are freed from yours. Leachar She'amut Ba'alech, or Leachar She'tamut Achotech. After your husband dies, or after your sister, who's presently married to me, dies. Le'achar she'atzlo yachlotzlach yivimech eina mikudeshet, or after your brother-in-law, with whom you are in a connection of levirate marriage because of the death of your husband, after he does chalitza for you, you're mikudeshet to me. In all of these cases, eina mikudeshet. Vechein ha'omer lechaviro im yalda ishtecha nekeva harezu mikudeshet li eina mikudeshet. The man says to his friend, if your wife gives birth to a female child, she'll be mikudeshet to me. Similarly there is no kiddushin. In all of these cases, the Mishnah is teaching us that the statement of the man has no validity. She's not mikudeshet. Even if she wants to accept the offer, she can't do it now. She has to wait until her personal status or his personal status changes and makes them available one to the other kehalacha. And then in the Gemara, we saw that the sugya of the Gemara is not based on this Mishnah, but rather it is what we call a Tnan Hatam sugya. And a Tnan Hatam sugya is a sugya that is founded on a Mishnah somewhere else, but it involves our Mishnah, the one we're studying here, by means of the discussion on the Mishnah over there. And it's filed here and not there, because over there is no Bavli. And therefore, it's filed here because of its connection, albeit indirect, to our Mishnah. And this Tanan Hatam Sugya begins with a Mishnah from Masechet Trumot, which says, "Ein tormin mina talush ala mechubar, ve'im taram ein trumato truma." That you cannot separate truma from that which is already harvested for that which is still attached to the ground. And if you did, the truma is not effective. And so, from this, What we learned is that just like in the situation of the kiddushin that we read in the Mishnah, that there are certain times when when a mitzvah cannot be performed, either because the produce has not been removed from the ground, it has not yet entered the category of being able to be used to separate truma, or the woman is not free to marry, or the man is not free to marry. In any of these cases, the mitzvah cannot be accomplished. But on this Mishnah Trumot, that if a man wants to separate Truma from that which is harvested, on that which is not yet harvested, he can't do it. Be'ah mine Rav Asi Rav Yochanan. Rav Asi, the third generation Amora, asks his Rebbe, Rav Yochanan ben Napacha in Tveria, Amar Pirot Arugazu Tzlushim, Yu Truma o Pirot Arugazu Mechubarim, Pirot Arugazu Mechubarim, Yu Truma o Pirot Arugazu Tzlushim, Lechashayi Talshu, Vinit Lashu, Mao. He asks him, okay, assuming that what the Mishnah is saying is correct, that you cannot take truma from that which is harvested on that which is not, or from that which is not on that which is, what happens if the man says, this portion of the field will be truma, because they're already cut, will be truma for that which is, for that portion of the field which is still attached, or that portion of the field which is still attached will be truma for this portion of the field which is harvested when they are harvested, meaning that those parts which are not yet harvested they will be part of this formula when they are harvested. And then they are harvested, then what will be the din? And Rabbi Yochanan answered Rav Asi, Kol shebiyado lav kemechusar ma'aseh dami. That anything that is in his hand to finish, he has the power to harvest it. It's his field. He can do what he pleases with it. Then that's not considered mechusar ma'aseh, and he can actually use the still attached grain as truma on the one that is already harvested, or the other way around, because he's saying when I detach it, when I harvest it, this will become effective. And since it's in his power to do that, then it's perfectly legitimate, and it's okay. And Rav Asi then asks the question of Rabbi Yochanan from our Mishnah here in Kiddushin. Ha'omer le'isha hariyat mikudeshet li le'achar she'et kayer, o le'achar she'tit kayri, le'achar she'eshtachrer, o le'achar she'tishtachreri, le'achar she'amud ba'alech, o le'achar she'tamud achotech, le'achar she'yachlot la'chivimech, ena mikudeshet. He asks this question, and we do not have an answer from Rabbi Yochanan to this question. Question is an obvious one, because if you say that kol shebiyado lav kemechusar ma'aseh, anything that's in a person's hand to accomplish, it's not considered lacking anything, and it qualifies to be used for the mitzvah, then in our case of the kiddushin also, why in all of these cases is the woman not mikudeshet? So you might say, okay, fine. In a case where he has to wait until she converts, so that's not in his power to convert her. After he's freed, it's not in his power to free himself. And after she is freed, it's not in his power to free her from her slavery either. And after your husband dies, or after my wife dies, these things are not considered to be in our hand, because no one assumes that a person is going to do murder for such a purpose. Or after the chalitza is done, but he has no control over when it will be done. I can understand that these things are not in his control. But after I convert, isn't it in the power of a person to convert? This is the question of the Gemara in component number 4. And in component number 5, the Gemara explains how it's not in his control, because in order to convert, he has to appear before 3 judges. And who says these 3 judges are going to accept what he has to say and convert him? So therefore, it's not in his control. And Rabbi Yochanan's position remains standing. That is, that anything that is in his control is not considered mechusar ma'aseh. And therefore, this etivei, which was brought by Rav Asi from our Mishnah, falls. It's not relevant. It doesn't impact negatively on Rabbi Yochanan's general principle whatsoever. Then we have in component number 6, matkifla Rabbi Arba Abba Bar Mamal. So Rabbi Abba Bar Mamal challenges Rabbi Yochanan's klal. You see, now that the challenge of Rav Asi from Abraita has fallen, now Rav Abba Bar Mamal attacks it logically, and he says that elemeata, if Rabbi Yochanan, this is what you want to suggest, then hanotein prutala shivchato v'yamar hareat mikudeshet l'leachar she'ashachrech, it should be that this money is your kiddushin after I free you, hachinami d'havi kiddushin, then that should be perfectly good kiddushin, because it's in the power of the Adon to free her, and since it's in his power to free her, then she's not considered mechuseret ma'aseh, and therefore she should be able to accept kiddushin from him. So Rabbi Arba Bar Mamal is asking this question not on the basis of a braita, as did Rav Asi. He's asking it on a logical basis. So what's so problematic? Why can't Rabbi Yochanan say, hey, okay, sure, no problem? If he wants to give her a Shaveh Pruta and say she's mekudeshet him with this Shaveh Pruta after he frees her, that would be kiddushin. What's the problem with that? So the Gemara answers, Hachi Hashta, look here. Hata mi ikara behema hashta da vacheret. He can't be mekadesh shivcha because she has no dea. She has no independent thought or opinion. She belongs to her master, and therefore the kiddushin can't work. But when he is mishachrer, once he frees her, then she becomes a da'at acheret, an independent mind, an independent opinion. She can either accept his kiddushin or not. So therefore, that's why it doesn't work here. It's not because it's not biado. It's biado. It is biado. But Rabbi Yochanan means it's biado in the sense that the only thing missing is his action. But here it's not just that which is missing. Here there's 2 problems. Number 1, she's a slave. And number two, as a slave, she cannot express any independent halachic or behavioral opinion. So what the Gemara is saying is that Rabbi Yochanan's klal would not apply here, and therefore he can't be mekadesh his shifcha in this manner. The Gemara then goes on to ask, Elahad yamar Rabbi Yoshaya, what about what Rabbi Yoshaya said? And this becomes an important question on Rabbi Yochanan, because Rabbi Yoshaya is the generation before Rabbi Yochanan. And therefore, if Rabbi Yochanan disagrees with him, he's in hot water. So Rabbi Yoshaya says, Hanotein putal lishto, v'amar la hareat mikudeshet li, v'achar she'agarshech, eina mikudeshet. That if a man is married to a woman, and he gives her a shaver putah, and he says to her, my lifelong companion, my dear friend, I'm going to divorce you now, but here's a pruta so that after I divorce you, you're going to be automatically remarried to me. And Rabbi Yoshaya said, this is not good. She's not mikudeshet. Why is she not mikudeshet? And the reason is the same as we saw by the shivcha, that when a woman is married, that she's not able to accept kiddushin from another man. She's already been spoken for. She's exclusively within the interpersonal relationship with her husband. And therefore, when he says to her, I'm going to divorce you, and then I want you to marry me with this Shaver Pruta, she can't agree now, because she's not capable of receiving Kiddushin. And when he divorces her, then can she decide, and she may decide yes, and she may decide no. And therefore, it's not in his control. And this eliminates then the question that we raised on Rabbi Yochanan based on the statement of Rabbi Oshia. Then in component number 9, the Gemara says, okay, if that's the case, then tifshot, then you can solve the problem that was asked by Rav Oshaya. Rav Oshaya is not Rabbi Oshaya. They're two different people. Rabbi Oshaya is a first generation Babylonian Amora. I'm sorry, a first generation Israeli Amora. And Rav Oshaya is a third generation Amora. He's after those, he's younger than those who are presented earlier in the sukkah. And Rav Oshaya says, Hanotein shtei prutot liisha. A man gives two prutot, two coins, to the same woman. V'achad amar la hitkatshi li ayom. V'achad amar la hitkatshi li liachar she'agarshech. He says to her, with the first coin, you'll be my wife. With the second coin, you'll be my wife again after I divorce you, that you should be able to resolve this question of Rav Oshaya, whether this can work or not, that it should not be Kiddushin. Because in the same way that a man cannot say to his wife, here's a Shaver Pruta for you to be Mikudesha to me after I divorce you, because she's not in a position to answer him. So in the same way, we could say here that she's not in a position to answer him, because she can only answer him about the first Kiddushin. But once that first Kiddushin takes hold, she's in no position to answer him about the second Kiddushin. The Gemara says, well, maybe not. The reason why Rav Oshaya asked this question is because this is a different case. When he gives her the two coins, she's not married to him at all. And if she's not married to him, in the same way that she can agree about the first Kiddushin, she should be able to agree about the second Kiddushin. And therefore, you would assume that both actions are correct, and this is really a case of lav mechusar ma'aseh, according to Rabbi Yochanan. And this is why we leave the question of Rav Oshaya intact, and we don't resolve it based on what was brought before. At the end of the sugya, we have a braita Tanya Kavate de Rabbi Yochanan, a braita which is in accordance with Rabbi Yochanan's opinion, that ein tormi mina telush ala mechubar v'im toram ein tromoto truma ketzad, that you cannot take truma from that which is harvested and that which is not harvested. And why is this? And how does this work? Amar, if a person said perot arugazu tzlushin, yutruma al perot arugazu mechuberet, o perot arugazu mechuberet, yutruma al perot arugazu tzlushin, lo amar klum, aval amar lechashi ital shuv and itlashu devorav kayamin. And this is basically what we have in component number 2, the question of Rav Asi from Rabbi Yochanan. You see that Rav Asi asks Rabbi Yochanan the question based on his own logic. He doesn't quote a braita, but here our Gemara is now quoting a braita that raises the same issue that Rav Asi raised in his question to Rabbi Yochanan. But it goes further, and it says, Yeter al kenama Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov said even more, went even further with this, and he said, Afilu Omar Pirot Arugazu Tlushin. You Truma, or Pirot Arugazu Mchuberet. Pirot Arugazu Mchuberet. You Truma, Pirot Arugazu Tlushin. Lechashi Aviu Shlish Vitoshu. Veviu Shlish Vinitashu. Divrav Kayamin. That not only does he have the possibility of saying when they are cut, they will become Truma, because then they're not Mechusar Masa. But even if they're growing, and they've grown less than one third of their total potential, and in that kind of a case, they're not considered yet to be a plant of any significance. But Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, if they've grown less than one third, and he says, when they bring one third, and they will be cut, then they will be counted, that's also good. In other words, that doesn't even have to be a minimal plant there. As long as there's something in existence, you can make a hatnaya, conditional statement, that as soon as it gets to the point where it becomes usable, that then it can become involved in a process of truma. And with here the sukkah ends. Now, this is what we learned last week. We went through the sukkah, and I'd like to just point out a couple issues of methodology here in the sukkah that we can take with us to further sukkahs. What is the Amoreik Sugya here, and what are the add-ons of the Stama? Please write to me in the chat box, what components, by number, do you think are part of the original Amoreik Sugya? Out of the 10 components, which components are the Amoreik components, and part of the Sugya originally? I'm waiting for your fingers. Who would like to suggest which part of the sugya are original parts of the Amoreik sugya here? Well, seeing no responses and hearing no responses, I will suggest it to you. Component number one, component number two, component number three, component number four, and component number six are the original pieces of the sugya. They are Israeli Amoraim talking about a certain specific issue. That's Rav Asi talking with Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Abba Bar Mamal. These are the Amoraic pieces of the original sugya. They're all Israelis. It's an Israeli Amoreik Sugya from the second and third generations. Now, if you'll note, in component number 8 and component number 9, we have two other Amoreik pieces mentioned. One from Rabbi Oshaya, which predates our Sugya, and one is from Rav Oshaya, which is antedated to our Sugya. The first one, in number 8, simply wants to extend what we've concluded from our Sugya into a statement of Rabbi Oshaya from a generation before, and say, well, then if what Rabbi Yochanan is saying is true, then how can Rabbi Oshaya say Eina Mekudeshet when it's in his hand to divorce her? So the Gemara answers, yes, it's in his hand to divorce her. It's not in his power to make her agree to the Kiddushin after he divorces her. And then Rabbi Oshaya's question about giving two prutot in advance to the woman for two sets of Kiddushin, we say that can't work either, apparently, for the same reason. But then the Gemara says, well, maybe it can work, because in the same time that she is able to accept Kiddushin for the first time, she can accept it for the second. So we have these two memras of Rabbi Oshaya and Rav Oshaya, these are not part of the original Israeli sugya. They're add-ons that are being brought by the Stamma de Gemara to discuss the implications of our sugya. Does everyone see that? Are you all with me? I'd be delighted to hear several of your voices, or see some of your pictures, or see you write on the chat box so I can know that I'm getting through. Okay. Tim429 says yes. Okay, very good. I'm not sure I know who Baruch is. When you say yes, Baruch, who is Baruch? From Detroit. Is he here with us? I don't see anyone named Baruch in the picture here. Unless Baruch is Tim 429. that will resolve a mystery from several weeks. Okay, in any event, since the stoma brings amarik statements that are not in sequence, yes, that's right. The stoma brings amarik statements that are not in sequence. Of course, you might want to say that that component number 9 is in sequence. It's third generation, together with Ravasi and Abba Bar Mamal, and you would be right by saying that, but still, that is we're not referring to that kind of a case here. That kind of a case comes in only because of the question that's brought in component number 8. Now, Byron asks, this is how to identify them as part of the stoma. That's correct. So this, we call this in Hebrew, stoma mishubatsa morai, stoma that has been, as it were, studded with amoraic material. Because remember that every later layer can bring in earlier materials part of their discussion. That doesn't make the early material quoted as part of the stoma discussion part of the actual discussion here on the page. We have a local sugya, and then we have the stoma coming on top of this local sugya. This stoma coming on top of the local sugya can bring in all sorts of things with it. It can bring in a pasuk, it can bring in a tana, it can bring in an amora, and it just sits on top of the other sugya. But you shouldn't fall into the mistake of thinking that because it's amoraic, that it's part of the sugya. Not necessarily. It can be brought by the stoma. This is one of the main complications that we have in teaching this, because students make the mistake of thinking that because there's a memra, it's part of the original sugya. Not necessarily. It could be part of the stoma being brought in the sugya. So Byron from Toronto again asks, originally, at this point of change of sequence, we would have thought the sugya ended. Yes, yes, and it does. It does. At the end of component number 6, the sugya is over. The amoraic sugya is over. But then we have the second layer. Remember, the sugyas are operating like this. You have an amoraic sugya, and it ends at a certain date. The stoma sugya, which overlays on top of it, ends much later. So it can bring in all sorts of other materials surrounding it and as part of its discussion of the amoraic sugya. But the amoraic sugya itself is unaware that on top of it is floating all of this stoma material. It's unaware of it because the stoma material is some 200 years later or 250 years later than the amoraic sugya. Okay? In one of my meetings this past week with one of the leading Rabbanim in Israel, he asked me, what makes you think that the Stoma de Gemara is later than the Amoraic material? Maybe the Stoma de Gemara is simply reporting what was discussed in the Amoraic academies, and therefore it's just as authentic and original Amoraic material as is the named Amoraic material. And there, and according to his mind, the difference between the Amoraic material and the stoma would be that this is named and this is not named, or that this is concrete psak and this is not concrete psak, but that is all be Amoraic material, and therefore all included in the editing of the Gemara of the Amoraic material by Rav Ashi and Ravina. So I said to him, quote Rav, that's not likely, because if that was the case, well, all of you answer. How would you answer this, Rav, about the stoma being part of the Amoraic editing, just being different in its nature than the Mamers? Would you buy this argument or not? And if not, why not? Come. Don't you have microphones, everybody? Speak into your microphones. It's so much fun, more fun than just writing it in the chat box. No, there are no remarks, no questions, no remarks on this. The answer is, I said to him, that if it indeed, the Stoma de Gemara is just discussion of the Amoraim brought in a different literary format, but it's just as ancient as the Amoraim, then I would expect, at least in a certain number of places and shas, that the Amoraic Memrot, or any statement of the Amora, would take into account the concepts, expressions, even words that the Stoma de Gemara uses. After all, if it was aware of it, if the Stoma de Gemara is coming from the Amoraic period, let's say it's coming from generation 5, then the Amoraim from generations 5, 6, 7, 8 should be aware of what the Stoma is saying and use its concepts, its expressions, that sort of thing. If the Stoma material is coming from the second generation, then I would expect every generation from 2 to 8 to relate to it in some way. Use it, answer it, discuss it. But they don't. We don't have any sugyas like that. in Shas, maybe one, maybe two, not out of 10,000, where you see that the Amoraim are relating to the Stam of the Gemara. And that tells you quite clearly that the Stam of the Gemara is later. And if it's later, then it's, then that explains why the Amoraim in a sukkah like ours do not relate to the questions brought up from Rabbi Hoshaya and Rav Hoshaya. Okay, is this sukkah clear? Is it all clear to you how it's organized? Of course, we can go into Rishonim and analyze the sukkah much more deeply, but we're not going to do that because the purpose of these lessons is to give the participants a chance to learn the method rather than just the normal depth that we do in yeshivas. Byron is asking, could we say that the fact that the Amoreg statements are in Hebrew, they are earlier? Yes, that is certainly one of the telltale signs, because the reason that they are in Hebrew was so that they could be memorized the way the Mishnah is memorized. That's why they're in Hebrew, and that's why they have the name of the Amora attached to them, because they're Psak Halacha, and we need to know who it is that's paskening. But the stomach of the Gemara, which is in Aramaic and is anonymous, it's because it has a different function in the sugya. Okay, I hope all of this is clear and we can move on. Now, last week, Eitan from Toronto, Eitan Diamond, asked a very, very good question. He said that if you look at the beginning of sugya 17, it follows up on the Braita that's brought at the end of sugya 16 by talking about Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov. And who is it that's discussing Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov in sugya number 17? Rabba and Rav Yosef. Who are Rabba and Rav Yosef? They are the two Roshei Yeshiva of Pumbedita in the third generation. Rabba ruled for 22 years, and after him, Rav Yosef for 2.5. And they are, therefore, of the same historical period and the same generation as are the Amoraim that are part and parcel of the Israeli sugya in number 16. So Eitan asked, if that's the case, how do I know that sugya 17 is not just simply a continuation of sugya number 16? Why did I make it into two separate sugyas in the sheets where this is 16 and this is 17? He says, I wouldn't have known how to divide that on my own, and the method is supposed to be transparent so that anyone who's using it should be able to use it with the equivalent results. And Eitan's question is well taken. And I mentioned last week that the reason why we consider it to be a different sugya is because of the content, that the content goes off on a tangent beyond what is mentioned in sugya number 16. However, there is something else that needs to be mentioned, and that is not just the tangent. Look at who's speaking. In sugya number 17, Rabba and Rav Yosef are Babylonian Amoraim from the third generation. Who's speaking in the first sugya? Israeli Amoraim from the third generation. Now, Babylonian Amoraim do not continue discussions started by Amoraim in the same generation in Israel, because the material doesn't get to them that fast. They continue discussions of Rabbi Yochanan from the second generation, from Amoraim of the first generation, but not of the third. And the fact that you have generations 2 and 3 in sugya 6 and generation 3 in sugya 17, that doesn't mean that sugya 17 is a continuation of sugya 16. Not at all. It means that it's dovetailing, that in the same way that there's something in common between these two sukkahs, that means that they were put together, but that not that they're a continuation one of the other. And I think you can all see what is the connector between sugya 16 and 17. What is that connector? Come. Type it in. Shout it out. What is the connector that would force sugya 17 to be placed here? Byron, can you speak into your mic? I saw your name lighting up there for a minute. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Maybe connect your mic better. Maybe tech support can be of assistance to you in doing that. In any event, the connector between the two sugyas is the braita that is component number 10 in sugya number 16. Because this braita served in sugya number 16 to give the sukkah support for Rabbi Yochanan. And we mentioned that this braita was not known to the earlier Amoraim, or they would have brought it. It's brought by the Gemara. And this braita, once brought, now becomes the basis of sukkah 17. Because if you look at sukkah 17, Rabbah and Rabbi Yosef are arguing what is the intention of Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, who appears at the end of the braita, at the end of sukkah number 16. So this is really a parallel sugya, in the sense that the first sugya is analyzing the words of Rabbi Yochanan by the third generation of Amoraim in Israel, and this sugya is a baraita being organized, being analyzed by the third generation Babylonian Amoraim in Pumbedita. And therefore it's two separate sugyot. Now I noticed that Eitan is not with us today, but I would be very happy if one of you from Toronto could take upon yourselves to share this with him, because I know that he has not been able to sleep since last Sunday when I told him it's two different sugyas. So I would like him to be able to sleep better, so please mention that to him. Let's now look at sugya number 17 and understand it for content. What was it that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov said in the Braita at the end of sugya 16? What he said was that not only can you say that the produce of a certain section of the field that are harvested can be truma for that which is not yet harvested, or that which is not yet harvested can be truma for that which is harvested, that you can do that not only when you say when they are picked, and then they are picked in actuality, but you can also say that when they get to a third of their growth level, which is the minimum growth level to be considered to be a grown specimen of that species. So he says that as soon, if you say that they're not yet at that level of a third, but you say when they will bring a third, they'll grow to a third of their potential, and then they will be harvested, then they can be truma. And he says, yes, that works okay. So based on that, Amar Rabba, at the beginning of sukkah number 17 on Daf Samach Bet, Amud Bet, Amar Rabba, Lo amar Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov ela b'shachat aval b'agam lo, that shachat and agam are different stages in the development of the wheat. And so he says, Rabba says that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov are only talking, he's only talking about wheat that is or a grain that has achieved a certain level of growth, so it's not significantly far away from a shlish that is mentioned by the Braita. But agam, which is just the very beginning of the growth of the grain, it's where the grain grows up and its head, which is still heavy because of the seed, falls over, tips over. That's called agam, because of the pasuk that's brought a little while later, halachof ke'agmon rosho. And so Rabbi is saying that Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov's statement, that a person can make a preconditional statement, that when the produce gets to be a third, and then it's picked, it can then serve as truma one on the other, that's only when it's at shachat stage, not when it's still in agam stage. But Rav Yosef says, afilu ba'agam, even in agam stage, not a problem. The condition will hold equally as much. When he says that there'll be mikut, that the grain can be counted as truma on that which is not yet harvested, when it brings a third, it can be as soon as you know it's there. It doesn't have to be necessarily at the level of shachat. Notice that the two Maimrod are in Hebrew, even though the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumedita are in Bavel. And then comes Rabbi Eliezer. I'm skipping 3 Aleph because it's Stamad Gemara. 3 Bet says, Amar Rabbi Eliezer, Halachof Ke'agmon Rosho. He brings a Pasuk to back up the distinguishing mark brought by Rabbah, the difference between Shachat and Agam. Then we have, at the end of the sugya, Ika de Amre, some people say that that it's different, that Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef didn't argue about that, they argued about something else. Lo amar Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, ela b'shachat devei kivsha, aval b'shachat devei shakya, lo. But Rabbi Yosef amar, afilu b'shachat devei shakya. So that everyone is talking about shachat, no one's talking about agam, as we thought in the first version of their argument, but they're talking about two internal stages within the shachat, whether that is considered enough to do this process. And Rabba says no. Rav Yosef says Shachat Deveshakya is okay. And then we have in the Gemara, in component number 4 and in component number 8, we have the Gemara asking, based on our conclusion about the machloket between Rabba and Rav Yosef, who then, according to which opinion, would the following Mishnah go? Ha'omer lechaviro im yalda ishtecha nekeva mekudeshet li lo amar klum. If a man says to his friend, if your wife gives birth to a girl, she's mekudeshet to me, it has no status. The statement has no status. Ve'amar Rabbi Chanina, and on that Rabbi Chanina said, lo shanu ela she'en ishto me'uberet. That the only time that this doesn't work when he says if you're to his friend that if your wife gives birth to a female that she'll be mikudeshet me, that the only time Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov said that is not about an unborn baby, but rather only when his wife is, when the wife is not when, when the only when the wife is already pregnant. It's not, he can't just say to his wife in some kind of speculative way that 5 years from now, if your wife gets pregnant, the baby and the baby's in nekeva, a female shall be mekudeshet to me. But rather, there has to be a sign that there's something there already. So if the woman is pregnant, then you can see that the fruit of the womb is coming. It's like shachat, where it would be that where it's where Rav Yisrael ben Yaakov would say that he could do this. But if it's before that, the pregnancy is not showing yet, that would be like agam, where it's before the time that it reaches the quality or the quantity where it can then be utilized for that purpose. And this question is repeated again in number 8 on the second rendition of the argument. But because we are in the second rendition, we have Shachat de Kivsha and Shachat de Veshakya, which are closer one to the other. Then Rabbi Chanina's statement, when we ask who is it would be going according to, we can say it goes according to both Rabba and Rav Yosef. Whereas in the first case, we said it can only go according to Rabba. Because if it was going according to Rav Yosef, you would say that even if the Ubar has not been recognized yet, even if the pregnancy is not clear enough yet, still it would work. So in other words, what our Gemara has done, it's taken an argument of Rav and Rav Yosef in interpreting the statement of Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov and our Braita. This argument of Rabbi Rabba and Rav Yosef has two versions that are brought in component number 1 and 2 and then in component number 6 and 7. And the Gemara wants to distinguish these two statements of the argument between Rabba and Rav Yosef by what exactly you'll do with the case of the man who wants to meet with Kadesh, the daughter of his friend's wife, even though she's not yet pregnant. Okay, now, this sugya 17, just kind of flows right out of sugya number 16, in the sense it uses the Braita, and it discusses similar concepts, but it's nevertheless a different sugya for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, on a historical level. Are there any questions about Sugya 16, or for that matter, for Sugya 17, as a continued explication of Sugya 16? Any questions in writing, by voice? No questions? How is that possible? Okay, what I would like to suggest then, if these two sugyas are clear, is I want to change the subject, because I'd like to introduce a book to you that you may not be familiar with, but at this time of year you should be, and since not all of our participants are here right now. Tim 429 is asking, Matkif is a logical attack, and Meitav is from a source. This is a rule? Yes. Yes, Baruch, this is a rule. Without any doubt, Meitive and Eitive and Mativ and Motiv and Otiv, these are all statements or questions asked on an Amora from a Braita, from a source. Whereas Matkifla is a logical challenge based either on the normative halakha or just what makes good sense. Kiel is asking, what are the other statements in sukkah number 17? Okay, well, if you look in sukkah number 17, number 1 and 2 is the machloket Rabban Rav Yosef, right? You with me, Gil? Number 6 and 7 is the same machloket, again, just with a slightly different version. Number 3 and numbers 8 are parallel. In both of those two cases, the Gemara is asking, based on how you've set up the machloket, how will you understand the following statement? And the answer is given in 4 Aleph 4 and 8 Aleph 4. So the two parts of the sugar are exactly in parallel one with the other. Okay, now, the book that I'm holding up here, which I hope some of you are familiar with, is called Haggadat Chazal. The Haggadah of Chazal. This was put together by the two Safrai brothers. One was a historian and one an archaeologist, and they were brilliant scholars, and they put together this Haggadah for Pesach, which explains how the Seder went through different stages of development, how the Haggadah, more correctly, went through certain stages of development and became the way it is now. What sections were done in the Bayit Sheni, which were done in the Tannaitic period, which in the Amoraic period, which in the Gaonic period, etc., etc. And it's fascinating reading. It's loaded with introductions that explain how all these things developed. And then it has the actual Haggadah in it with an interpretation, with a pirush that explains everything and brings all sorts of interesting realia, such as, if I don't know if you're able to see it here, but this is a these are parchments that that had interesting information on them, or a ketaviyat like this, and it's has very, very interesting things. I recommend that you get it, and I even wanted to recommend that possibly through our lesson in advance of Pesach, that we actually do some work on the Seder, because I think it will help you to conduct the Seder in a more accurate and source reliable fashion. Byron is asking, who are the authors? The authors are Shmuel and Zev Safrai. Samech Pe Resh Aleph Yud, in English, Safrai. The work has not been translated into English. It's in Hebrew, but the Hebrew is not that difficult. And I'd recommend it should be in the Haggadah library of any serious person as he prepares for Pesach. Okay. Are there any questions on the two sugyas that we learned today? Because today I have to end a little bit early. I'm broadcasting from New Jersey. I just got in this morning from Israel, and there's something that I need to take care of right away. But I didn't want to miss our lesson. Are there any questions or about what we learned today before we sign off? Okay, so we're going to meet again next Sunday, and I hope these sukkahs have been clear. Next Sunday we will proceed with sukkah number 18, and possibly with sukkah number 19 as well. We'll see how much we cover. Try and prepare them before then, and have a Shavua Tov, a wonderful week, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Sunday, same time, same station. All the very best. Bye-bye.